Are you ready to begin?
Yes, I'm all set here.
Any program about science or scientists today is almost bound to focus on space.
Okay, Houston, the Challenger has landed.
Houston Station, we are ready for the event. Thank you.
It's another Space Boffins podcast with real space boffins. I'm Richard Hollingham.
And I'm Sue Nelson.
And this time we'll be celebrating British rockets on the Isle of Wight and from the agency that brought us the internet and stealth bombers, a spaceship to take humanity to the stars.
Virgin Galactic's plans to be the first company to offer suborbital spaceflight are getting closer to fruition. It named its first pilot in the summer and just a few weeks ago opened Spaceport America in New Mexico.
Virgin Galactic is on track to be the world's first commercial space line, and today is a major milestone on our path to commercial operations from Spaceport America.
And we're delighted to be joined by Virgin Galactic's commercial director, Stephen Attenborough, who was also there at the launch. Now, around 500 people have already bought tickets, costing £127,000 each. What are they going to get for their money?
You're right on the number. It's rapidly approaching 500. They come from around, I think, 46 countries now around the world, aged between, I think, 18 and a little over 90 now.
Wow.
What are they going to get? They'll join us at Spaceport America, and they'll spend 3 or 4 days with us. So they don't have to devote half their life to becoming an astronaut. This is a long weekend. And for the first 3 days, they'll be undertaking a number of activities, which are primarily designed to do two things. Firstly, to make sure that they travel safely with us. And secondly, that they have an incredible experience. But then we'll also be really focusing on making sure we simulate as much as possible of what is going to be a very, very intensive couple of hours. You know, every stage of this space flight is going to take them to new sensory levels. I think what we want to do, particularly as with Virgin on the tail of the spaceship, is to make sure that people come back safely, but they also come back with a big smile on their face.
So when they get into the craft, I know they are White Knight 2, I know they are Spaceship 2. It's Spaceship 2 that goes into suborbit.
Spaceship 2 is the spaceship. That's
yes,
an easier way,
the easy way to remember it.
They are always going to be sitting in the spaceship from the start. But at the beginning of the flight, the spaceship, Spaceship 2, is attached to our carrier aircraft, which is called White Knight 2. And so White Knight 2 will take Spaceship 2 and the passengers, clearly, up to around 50,000 feet. So it's a normal runway takeoff. There's a 10,000-foot runway down at Spaceport America, and you have a slow but steady climb up to about 50,000 feet. But at the point they get to 50,000 feet, when everybody's ready, the pilot will give the countdown, and then the pilots on board White Knight 2, the carrier aircraft, pull a lever, and Spaceship 2 falls away from the carrier aircraft. That's really when the ride starts properly. So you're already, you know, at an altitude that is maybe 10,000 feet higher than most people have ever flown at. You can already see just a little bit of the curvature of the Earth. But as you fall away, there'll be a little sort of feeling in the stomach as the spaceship goes into a glide. And then, again, when everybody's happy and ready, the pilots of the spaceship will give another countdown, and then they will light the rocket motor. And that's when the environment inside the spaceship changes pretty dramatically, because you're travelling maybe at about 100 knots at that point, and you accelerate straight forwards, first of all, and you'll be at the speed of sound in just under 8 seconds.
So that's a fast acceleration.
Well, it's very similar, actually, to the amount of acceleration that fast jet pilots get as they're catapulted off the deck of an aircraft carrier. The difference with this is that on the aircraft carrier, you know, it's a kick and then it's over. This is a kick that keeps kicking for quite an amount of time. There's vibration, there's a lot of noise. You are pressed back into your seat, weigh about 3.5 times as much as you did. And then the pilots actually pitch the nose of the spaceship pretty much into a vertical climb. And so you have the G-forces, if you can think, when you're going straight forwards, are coming through your chest. And as the spaceship pitches upwards, they go from head to toe for a very brief period of time. And that's probably the most demanding part of the G-force profile. And that's the point where you may need to do a little bit of G sort of tolerance maneuvers. And then as you're hurtling straight upwards again, the G's come straight through the chest again. So a lot more comfortable. And you keep accelerating for about half a minute, and you reach almost 4 times the speed of sound. There's a lot of noise, a lot of vibration, a lot of G-forces. You're heading straight upwards, hurtling away from the Earth's surface. Outside the windows, the sky is changing colour from blue through to purple and gradually to black. After about 70 seconds, you will have achieved the necessary velocity to get to the apogee that we're heading for, which is about 110, 120 kilometres above the Earth's surface, and the pilots will shut down the rocket motor. This, again, is evidently a very intense moment, because the environment inside the cabin changes dramatically. You're just getting used to the G-forces, the vibration, the noise, and then suddenly all of that goes away. And this is the first manned spacecraft which has no internal fans or machinery. We deliberately kept the environment inside the spacecraft free of noise, because one of the things that we want people to experience is the silence of space.
So this is the period when they'll be weightless.
And at the same time, you become weightless.
Is this just a theory at the moment, or can you actually do it? Has anyone done
this? No, this is absolutely not a theory. The only reason that Virgin got behind this particular technology is because we knew it worked. This goes right back to 2004, when the Ansari X Prize, the $10 million prize, was won by the prototype, I suppose, of our vehicles. Spaceship One was the world's first privately built manned spaceship, and it had to go into space twice in the period of 14 days with a man on board, achieve an altitude of at least 100 kilometres above the Earth's surface, and Spaceship One did it. That vehicle was built by Scale Composites, which was headed by Bert Rattan, and we had become convinced, as we'd seen that project evolve, that this was probably the opportunity. Bert Rattan, who is probably the world's greatest aeronautical engineer and designer, his philosophy has always been, keep it simple. And he deliberately looked for ways to do that in the key parts of the spaceship, which have always created safety difficulties, and that's particularly on launch and re-entry. And the reason that, as you were saying, we have two vehicles rather than one, is because he believed that, air launch of spacecraft was fundamentally safer than ground launch. So we have got everything on our side to make this happen. But it is hard. It's a hard thing to get right from day one. And we have always said that we will not fly Richard and his kids or any of our other commercial passengers until we are absolutely satisfied that this is as safe as it can be, which will never be risk-free. But we do need to start this commercial operations with levels of safety which have been unheard of to date in manned space travel, and we think we can get there.
Well, we'll continue this conversation, but for now, Stephen Attenborough, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, it's been more than 40 years since the peace and rural tranquility of High Down on the Isle of Wight was broken by the roar of rocket engines. This was where Britain's Black Knight and Black Arrow launchers were tested before being shipped to Woomera in Australia for launch.
Black Knight has had 17 successful launchings. It is a ballistics research vehicle powered by the Gamma motor. It will be developed as a three-stage rocket to launch satellites in different orbits.
To celebrate Black Knight, Black Arrow and the 40th anniversary of Prospero, the first and only British satellite to be launched on a British rocket, space fans and retired space boffins from across the UK gathered at High Down on the 28th of October for Orbit Offsite. The event featured activities that paid tribute to Britain's rocket pioneers, including the return of working pulse jet rocket engines. The day was organised not by a rocket scientist, but by multimedia artist Katayoon Dolatshahi.
I was astounded that here on the Isle of Wight, the British space programme was active and alive, and somehow that jarred with my memory of the island being a kind of beach resort for holidaymakers. So there's this whole other life, and I wanted to kind of bring that to light. And I was really inspired not just by the archaeology of the place and what's here, but also by the vision and what they achieved here.
My name's Bruce White. I was head of systems analysis, and I also was team leader on one of the Black Knights and Black Arrow R1.
Colin Chambers, and I was an engineer here.
My name is Derek Mack, and I was chief trials engineer up here. I was responsible for looking after the operational side of things.
My name is Harold Ashton. I was the third person to join the Black Knight team. I was here for 2 years, and during that 2 years, whilst we were constructing the site, I did duties there, but I also came responsible for the first sequence of launching the static rocket, and also the command and control of the rocket itself.
Cliff Maidment. I was from the design side, aerodynamics and systems design.
My name's Jim Scragg. For my sins, I worked up here in the early days of Black Knight and Black Arrow. Thoroughly enjoyed it.
Just describe what it was like, because we're looking along this crescent of
of concrete, almost like a concrete road that's built into the cliff, and then below it, as if we're on the roof of these concrete gantries built out again into the cliff below us.
It would have looked very different because at the end of the arc, there would be a 40 or 50 feet high aluminium clad gantry, as we used to call them, but a servicing tower, if you like. Each one had a winch to lift the rocket into. You can't see the big metal structure on which it sat for static firings. The object was that we wanted to prove there was a vehicle that would do exactly what we hoped it would do, what we designed to do, when it was launched in Australia. And so we did everything here that they would do in Australia except to let it go.
There's excitement building now on the headlands because they're about to fire a pulse jet. The team that built it are apprentices, Astrium apprentices from Portsmouth and Stevenage. And I'm with two of the team leaders. They are Curtis Mew and Thomas Hunt. Thomas, what is a pulse jet?
A pulse jet is really a self-perpetuating engine. All you do is you put your propane and your air or an explosive fuel into the combustion chamber. That ignites, creates a low pressure, which draws in new fuel, new cold air, and that heat of already there in the pulse jet and the combination of the new fuel and oxygen mixture reignites itself.
It's supposed to be pretty loud as well, is that true?
Very loud, quite a distinctive drone.
It's actually quite exciting. It's interesting seeing like the older generation and how they've influenced our technology nowadays, and it's just hopefully we go on into the future just to have the same effect on the next generation, really.
We've got these pulse jet engines booming out behind us. Jim, how does this compare to the Black Arrow when that was here?
Oh, well, obviously there is a lot more sound, a lot more sonic vibration going on when we lit up either Black Arrow or Black Knight. The sound of that was much lower frequency, and it was more like the Queen Mary or Queen Elizabeth. And we only fired them here for 35 seconds anyway. But seeing the end of that firing of that pulse jet down there, where the flame sort of comes out, that's exactly the same sort of shutdown that we had in our engines, both on Black Knight and Black Arrow.
Nicholas Hill, you're author of The Vertical Empire. What sort of impact did Black Arrow launching of Prospero have on Britain at the time?
Difficult, actually, because there was so much else going on with the Apollo landings and so on that I don't think many people in Britain at the time noticed it. It's only later that people began to realise what went on and what they lost.
Should explain that the reason there was applause in the background was not because of what you were talking about, but because children are actually making water rockets of their own up here on the site where British rockets used to be tested. Going back to Britain, do you think that's a particularly British attitude to sort of not make that much of a fuss, not showcase the expertise that was here at the time, and the fact that what they were doing was cutting edge?
It was cutting edge, and the trouble was that the people who had the money, the Treasury, were against it, and it's they who often said, you've got to keep it quiet. Plus the fact that some of the early work was military-related, and so it was under security anyway, so they couldn't talk about it even if they wanted to.
Do you feel that we've put all that behind us now? We're fighting our way back into a prominent position within the space community for Europe?
Yes, one of the great success stories was Surrey Satellites, and they were, in fact, if you like, a vindication of what the Treasury was saying at the time. If it's worth doing, private industry can go out and do it properly and make money out of it. Why are we subsidising these rockets which won't make money? And you can see their viewpoint to some extent. Although, if everyone said that, we wouldn't have any rockets at all.
A model Black Arrow rocket firing into the sky over the Isle of Wight. And if you're quick, you can still see Cataune's space-inspired artwork at Key Arts in Newport, Isle of Wight, until the beginning of December. And talks are taking place as we speak for it also to appear in Portsmouth in the new year. We'll put a link to her work on our Facebook page. Just search for Space Boffins. Now, Stephen, we heard Nicholas Hill just at the end there. I think his phrase was, in the 70s, if it's worth doing, then private industry can do it. That's pretty much worked out, hasn't it?
I think it has, although it's probably taken too long. If Richard Branson was sitting here, you know, he would say that he started Virgin Galactic really because he always wanted to go to space and gradually became aware that NASA and the other government space agencies were very unlikely to take him there. We are clearly believers in the future of commercial space. NASA and the, you know, the other big government space agencies have done a great job, really, I guess, in breaking that final frontier. But there is a time when I think the private sector can take over the reins and do a much better job in some ways, Lily.
Is that going to be the case beyond the sort of suborbital flights that you're doing? Do you think that'll be the case with private companies taking over orbital flights and then maybe looking at space exploration as well?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's quite a lot to prove, and our responsibility, if you like, is to show that you can take ordinary people into the intrinsically unfriendly environment of space on a very, very regular basis. Keep them safe, give them a good time, and make money from it. If you look back at other industries, maybe the internet even, or mobile telephony, or other industries that have come out of government-sponsored technology, when that technology is released to the private sector, then there's almost an unlimited wall of money that floods into that sector, and you see very rapid innovation. But unless we get this first step right, then that's probably not going to happen.
But you've already signed a research contract with NASA.
We have, yeah. And so, I mean, we're great supporters of NASA. I mean, you know, we don't see ourselves in competition with them at all.
But does this mean a sort of you're looking to the future as both space tourism,
yeah,
and a sort of contractor for major space agencies to do suborbital research experiments?
Yeah. I mean, I think we look at ourselves as attempting to transform access to space. we want to make it more affordable, we want to make it safer, we want to make it more environmentally sustainable. And that's for
a phrase you often hear in relation to you've got that carbon composite, yeah, which makes it more spaceship more fuel efficient. Speaking about the experience,
yes,
though, we got a great description of getting up there,
yep,
what happens when you're up there, coming down.
Yeah, I think we just turned the rocket motor off, haven't we?
we left our astronauts up there. They're still there.
Yeah, how are you going to get down? Because I couldn't believe it when I read that Spaceship Two doesn't have heat shields.
No. Probably the greatest bit of innovation was the mechanism for re-entry. So just before we do re-entry, it's probably important for me to say that, you know, we deliberately designed a spaceship which enabled them to get out of their seats in zero gravity. You know, there's not a lot of point in being in the magic of zero gravity if you're strapped in
if you've got your seat belt on,
a small cabin. So it's a big cabin we've built. I mean, and it's got a lot of big windows as well.
So coming back,
yes,
then into re-entry, there are no heat shields.
No.
I assume that's because of the composition of the spaceship, the materials that you've used. And is it also the angle of re-entry?
It's a little bit of everything. I mean, again, you know, it's important to say that we're coming back from space a lot slower than the space shuttle. But this was Bert Rattan's genius at play, and what he decided to do basically was to change the shape of the spaceship while it was in space and base the philosophy on the aerodynamics of a shuttlecock. So a shuttlecock will always come down with ball first, so aerodynamically the attitude of the descent is controlled, and it'll come down clearly more slowly than a tennis ball because you've got the feathers which act as drag, air brakes. And so Bert decided if he could change the shape of the spaceship from a plane, effectively an aircraft, to a shuttlecock while it was in space, then he might have overcome the whole re-entry problem in one fell swoop, because it wouldn't matter if the spaceship came into the atmosphere, the upper atmosphere, upside down or on its side. You know, the shape of it at that point as it started to hit the upper atmosphere would mean that it would always come down belly first.
So is this why it's got foldable wings?
Foldable wings. So in fact, the whole
unfold
tail...
unfold coming down.
Yes, the whole tail structure, whilst it's in space, rotates up through to about 60 degrees to the fuselage. So it is a little bit like a shuttlecock, if you can imagine it. The other thing that these inverted tail section or inverted rotated wings do is obviously to slow the spacecraft as it falls through the upper atmosphere, which means there's no need for heat protection, there's no need for computer-controlled flight controls. The pilots pretty much sit there and do nothing whilst re-entry goes on. And then at 70,000 feet, once the spacecraft has been slowed sufficiently by these rotated wings, the wings are re-rotated back to the original configuration, and you have an incredible high-altitude glide all the way back down to the spaceport runway. You land, astronaut wings, party, And
lots of champagne.
Lots of champagne.
And you're going to get addicts, aren't you? You're going to get people that repeat are going to want to go repeat business. That's what you're aiming for, isn't it?
I mean, you know, yes. I mean, I think what we're aiming for, as I say, is we want to transform access to space. We have customers who are putting payload on the spaceship, customers are putting scientists on the spaceship, and also a lot of people just want to go for the experience.
Richard.
Well, let's look to the far future now. Robots, hypersonic aircraft, and a new type of paper shredder. No task is too big or too small for the Americans' Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA. After all, technology developed by this secretive military organization forms the basis of the internet. Well, now it's turning its attention to an 100-year starship to make long-distance space travel practical and feasible in 100 years. Icarus Interstellar is one of the groups rising to the challenge. Now, Icarus has its roots in Project Daedalus, a 1970s feasibility study for a fusion-powered interstellar mission conceived by members of the British Interplanetary Society. And that was led by Alan Bond, who's now one of the driving forces behind the Skylon space plane. Well, I went to the British Interplanetary Society to meet the Vice President of Icarus Interstellar, Kelvin Long, shortly after he'd returned from DARPA's 100-year Starship Study Symposium in Florida.
We're redesigning the original Daedalus design, and we're trying to produce a credible design in around 2014, which can demonstrate that interstellar travel is feasible and practically feasible in the coming century.
What's different about this from conventional spacecraft, conventional rockets?
Mainly the problem is the distance scales involved. They are enormously vast. The spacecraft such as the Pioneer and Voyager probes, they went at something like 3 astronomical units per year, an astronomical unit being the distance from the Earth to the Sun, the mean distance. To do something like interstellar travel, you need to be hitting about 3,000 astronomical units per year. And so the engineering problems with developing the technology to do that are enormous.
You've got a huge, huge effort to transform that sort of technology to something that can get out there and leave the solar system within a few years, presumably.
You have, but that's the whole purpose of science and developments, is to evolve technology so it's more efficient and can do more things more easily and cost less to do so. That's what the whole of engineering and science is largely about. There are probes which are, for example, Pioneer 6, which has been in space over 60 years, because one of the issues with sending these spacecraft is, will it actually last the time span? Now, the original Project Daedalus spacecraft, it took about 50 years to get to the destination. For Project Icarus, we're looking at something that takes about 100 years. Looking at historical probes, and with the advances in science, that seems perfectly feasible, provided you can get the engines to work.
And what sort of engines would you be looking at? I mean, a conventional rocket's not going to do it. What about electric propulsion, solar sails? Are those the sort of things you're thinking about?
Chemical propulsion, unfortunately, just doesn't have the performance to actually do interstellar missions. So things like nuclear electric are certainly good, and they will get you outside the solar system, perhaps 1,000 times the distance from the Earth to the Sun, but they still won't get you to the stars. Solar sails certainly have the potential to give you large accelerations if you can get close to the Sun to push you to those interstellar distances. The options that we're specifically looking at for Project Icarus is fusion, because fusion is an ongoing program on Earth. There's experiments going on at the moment to demonstrate the feasibility of ignition, for example, which is where you get fusion to work on Earth just like it does in the Sun. So we're exploring the use of that technology and possibly even antimatter propulsion.
And what moves this beyond a plan on a computer or on a bit of paper? But I mean, the British Interplanetary Society has got a long history of concept missions, but they don't really go anywhere. I mean, we're surrounded by these fantastic pictures of missions. Some, you can see a moon landing craft. That's not far off what actually happened. But a lot of them, they look fantastic, but they never actually happened.
A lot of these things start with an inspirational idea. The British Interplanetary Society in the 1930s came up with a lunar lander design. People like Ralph Smith and Arthur C. Clarke were involved in that. And then, of course, in the 1960s, the American Space Agency, NASA, took a spacecraft, the Lunar Excursion Module, and landed it on the moon in 1969. So the British Interplanetary Society didn't actually build the spacecraft, but they helped to seed the idea, along with others like Jules Verne and H.G. Wells in their science fiction stories. In engineering speak, there's a way of dealing with evolution of technology, which is something called technology readiness levels. It's a scale that goes from 1 to 9. Something that's at 1 is basically conjecture. It's just an idea. It's science fiction. So things like warp drive, for example, in Star Trek would be a technology readiness level of 1. Technology that's been developed and proved in the environment is technology level of 9. So that's the space shuttle, which has now just been retired, sadly. So what you have to do to move the technology on is to move it up this ladder, this scale of 1 to 9. And you do that by validation of your design by experiments.
I mean, this isn't just an idea that you've had. The Americans have just had a conference. DARPA's just had a conference. I mean, this is the same agency that brought us, what, advanced missile systems, the internet, some serious weaponry. They don't back losers, generally.
That's a really good point. The DARPA 100-year Starship study was launched in October 2010. What they want to do is to start an organization which will be called the 100-year Starship Study Organization. And they have the task of spending 100 years actually getting ready to build and design a starship and launch it to the stars. It's a big problem because it's not just technological, it's economic, it's sociological, it's a commercial problem. How do you sustain an organization for 100 years that's independent of government so that it can develop self-revenue and get to a point where it can actually design and launch a starship? And so that's what this conference was about. We've just attended. And Icarus Interstellar, which is the non-profit spin-off after forming Project Icarus, is one of the competitors of many that's going for the seed grant, which is $500,000.
They're effectively running a competition now to get the best idea, which they will then back. Are you in with a chance?
Yes, there are lots of good teams. I think whoever wins would have the role of embracing all of the other organisations as an umbrella organisation and bringing everyone together so that we can have a focused, organised programme of research. But what we would actually like to do is to build on the past developments in interstellar research and actually put together an organisation that can build this thing. I won't be alive when it actually gets built, and we're talking about something that could be launched in 100 years or so. But hopefully my children will be, and my grandchildren, and we can be proud of our efforts.
Kelvin Long from Project Icarus. We'll be following the development of Icarus here on the Space Boffins podcast, although not necessarily for the next 100 years. Stephen, it's hugely ambitious. I mean, what do you think of these sort of big, big ideas?
Yeah, I mean, it makes us look pretty small, doesn't it?
I was just going to say, you know, you're really lacking in ambition.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I think it's fantastic. You know, I mean, one of the people that I've had the privilege to meet a few times now is Professor Stephen Hawking, who would love to fly with us, and I hope he'll be able to do that. And you know, he's very clear that almost by definition, you know, our destiny as a species, you know, is going to be, you know, in interstellar travel. And so you have to start somewhere. And I think the things that stand out for me in the conversation that we've just heard is firstly, this great global collaboration. You know, that this is not just about the US military or the Russian military or the Chinese. It's about, you know, we've got to get the world's best brains onto this. And the other is that the existence of prizes and competitions. We wouldn't have a spaceship if it wasn't for a prize. You know, the whole history of commercial aviation was built on the provision of prizes, which were always put up for things that had never been done before and generally were considered as being impossible.
It has been mooted in the past that there might be a spaceport built in Britain. Scotland in particular has often been cited. Is that now sort of on the back burner?
It is on the back burner. I mean, there's some great things happening here in the UK. I mean, David Willetts' announcement back in July about amending the Outer Space Act and acknowledging one of Britain's best-kept secrets, that we're actually, you know, we have a big space industry here and actually a world-class space industry. Trying to encourage it through, you know, various amendments in insurance and liability and so forth. That's fantastic. So, I mean, I think that space is on the map in the UK. As far as Virgin Galactic is concerned, we will be starting our operations in New Mexico. It is US technology and it is governed by US regulation. It's nice to see a great British brand on it, having said that.
And your first pilot, and British, David McKay.
Scottish, in fact, yeah, with a green card now. And we have always said that, you know, eventually, if everything goes well, we would love to see spaceports around the world and Virgin Galactic operating around the world for space tourism, science and other markets. But we also have to be very focused in this project. And we also have to be very mindful and respectful that, you know, if we are able to bring or take the spaceship out of the United States, we're going to have to get export controls and clearances for that first, and we haven't applied for those yet. So with all those caveats, I would say that we absolutely hope to see the spaceship flying around the world, and because it's a British brand, of course it would be great to have it flying from the UK somewhere.
Stephen Attenborough, thank you very much for coming in. Stephen Attenborough, Commercial Director for Virgin Galactic. Thanks also to Kelvin Long and everyone who we met on the Isle of Wight. And that's the Space Boffins podcast, a Boffin Media production supported by the Atrium Space Insurance Consortium.
Do check out our Facebook page and say hello to us on Twitter. Next month, we've got a space shuttle engineer and a science-loving petrol head who sings songs about space. See you then.